Hello, and welcome to this audio edition of Philip Huscher's program notes for upcoming concerts by the Chicago Symphony Orchestra. I'm Rich Caparella, and concerts by the CSO on Thursday, March 20th through Saturday, the 22nd, feature guest conductor Jakub Hruscha and piano soloist Simon Trpceski. The program includes Rachmaninoff's Piano Concerto No. 1 and, after intermission, Dmitri Shostakovich's Symphony No. 11, the year 1905. And here are program notes by Philip Huscher on the Rachmaninoff Piano Concerto No. 1, a work lasting about 26 minutes. Although Rachmaninoff's music is sometimes confused with the treacly romanticism of the Hollywood soundtracks it once inspired, Rachmaninoff himself was a serious and aristocratic artist. He was one of the greatest pianists in history, an astonishing virtuoso in the heroic Liszt tradition. But there was nothing flashy about his stage manner. For a crowd-pleasing superstar, Rachmaninoff was surprisingly somber and remote. He rarely smiled or courted the audience, and even his close-cropped haircut, of a kind that is ubiquitous today but was highly suspect at the time, like that of a convict, as the Russian bass Fyodor Shalyapin said, suggested a stern presence. Shalyapin also scolded him for his curt, peremptory bows. Much later, Stravinsky called him a 6.5-foot-tall scowl. Rachmaninoff would have become famous if he had done nothing but concertize, but his true aspiration was to be a composer. At the Moscow Conservatory, his teacher, Nikolai Zarev, encouraged him to stick to the piano instead of writing music, but Rachmaninoff tried his hand at composing some piano pieces and an orchestral scherzo, and even started an opera, Esmeralda. Unable to choose between composition and performance, Rachmaninoff ultimately decided to pursue both, eventually becoming a fine conductor as well. In 1889, the year he and Zverev parted ways, he sketched and abandoned a piano concerto, but the one he began the following year is his first major work, the one that became his Opus 1. This is the score that sealed his fate as a composer, and it was completed in a rush of passion and elation, with Rachmaninoff working from 5 in the morning until 8 in the evening and scoring the last two movements in just 2.5 days. Rachmaninoff played the first movement with orchestra in a concert of student works at the conservatory in March 1892. At the time, Rachmaninoff was so certain of his score that he rejected the improvements suggested by the conductor and even corrected his tempos and interpretive ideas in rehearsal. But Rachmaninoff's estimation of his first piano concerto soon changed. By 1908, having written a second concerto of great popularity, he was impatient with the defects of his first. "Now I plan to take my first concerto in hand tomorrow," he wrote that April, "look it over, and then decide how much time and work will be required for its new version and whether it's worth doing anyway. There are so many requests for this concerto, and it's so terrible in its present form that I should like to work at it and, if possible, get it into decent shape." Instead, however, he composed a new concerto, his third, in 1909, tailor-made for his upcoming North American tour. Rachmaninoff introduced the work in New York in November, but it was the second concerto that he played for his debut with the Chicago Symphony Orchestra the following month. As it turned out, Rachmaninoff didn't get around to revising the first piano concerto until late in 1917 in the aftermath of the Russian Revolution. It was the last music he would compose in his homeland. Just before Christmas, he accepted an invitation to perform in Stockholm. His wife and two daughters eventually joined him there. The family settled temporarily in Copenhagen and, in 1918, moved to the United States. Rachmaninoff played the premiere of the new version of his first concerto in January 1919 in New York City, where the family had taken an apartment. Before he ever started work revising this concerto, Rachmaninoff commented, "It will have to be written all over again, for its orchestration is worse than its music." The new score is virtually a new piece, with the significant exception of the main themes themselves. "It is really good now," the composer later remarked. "All the youthful freshness is there, and yet it plays itself so much more easily." It's also a tighter, more shrewdly paced work. It has, therefore, the best of both worlds, marrying Rachmaninoff's earliest lyrical instincts with his mature sense of form and orchestration. Still, it failed to capture the public's heart like his great earlier successes. When I tell them in America that I will play the first concerto, they do not protest, he later admitted, but I can see by their faces that they would prefer the second or third. Rachmaninoff's first piano concerto begins with the high drama of fanfares and cascading piano triplets, so unlike the gently captivating openings of the second and third concertos. The piano dominates the proceedings, frequently reminding those who tackle the solo role that Rachmaninoff was a formidable pianist, with enormous hands and remarkable control even in the most frenetic passages. There are two lyrical main themes, both introduced by the orchestra, but much richer and more complex once the piano takes them over. The cadenza, predictably, is huge and dazzling. The slow movement, begun by solo horn over somber chords, turns into a nocturne not unlike those by Chopin, but decisively stamped by Rachmaninoff's emerging personal style, rich harmonic vocabulary, and glittering filigree of his piano writing. The finale begins as aggressive, athletic music. The piano plays streams of endless 16th notes and then turns soft at the center in a lovely interlude that is lavishly embroidered by the piano. The very end is of the Bring Down the House variety. Program notes by Philip Pusher on Rachmaninoff's Piano Concerto No. 1. And now on to the Shostakovich Symphony No. 11, the year 1905, a work lasting about 62 minutes. These notes are by guest annotator, the British composer and writer Gerard McBurney. One might have naively thought that when Stalin died in March 1953, Shostakovich would have found himself released from the crushing creative, personal, and political pressures of the dictator's last years. To some extent, this was the case, although nobody in the Soviet Union at the time imagined Stalinism would come to an end just because Stalin himself wasn't there. Certainly, Shostakovich's immediate creative response to Stalin's death was striking enough. The Tenth Symphony, a work of tremendous musical dynamism and vivid human scope. At the same time, during these early post-Stalinist years, the composer was also adding substantially to his reputation by releasing a number of powerful and already written works, like the first violin concerto and the fourth string quartet, which he had previously held back for fear of the consequences. Taken together, these old and new pieces gave every reason to suppose that Shostakovich would now experience a liberation of his genius. And yet, after the initial explosion of the Tenth, there actually followed one of his bleakest periods. Although a few important pieces date from this time, he spent a great part of his energies composing tub-thumping film music, music for unpretentious, practical use, and official music of one kind or another, including popular songs to sentimental words of the communist youth variety. His admirers were confused and disappointed, and he himself complained of frustration and depression. One major cause of his inertia at this period was the death of his wife, Nina Varzar, in December 1954. A distinguished scientist and an immensely strong character, Nina had been the rock on which his life had been built for many years. Their marriage had not been easy and was open, but without her, Shostakovich seemed, as several friends later remembered, rudderless, lonely, and confused. It was during this time that the composer began to acquire an unenviable reputation as an unadventurous conservative, a hack, an official Soviet bard. In the West, his music was written off by commentators as more or less irrelevant as the avant-garde discovered brave new worlds of sound and post-war popular music began to overwhelm the classical traditions. In his own country, the young and rebellious musical generation that came to maturity in those Khrushchev years looked harshly and askance at this dinosaur from another age. He was only 50. Half forgotten were the wonders and experiments of his early years, and even the vast and tragic ironies of his middle period symphonies seemed less important than they once had. Then, in the summer of 1957, while staying at his favorite dacha, country cottage, in Komarovo on the North Baltic coast, just west of Leningrad, Shostakovich produced his 11th symphony. The auguries were not good. At first hearing, this symphony confirmed the worst fears of the composer's detractors and at the same time found worryingly warm favor with Soviet officials who declared it one of the composer's most satisfactory and splendidly Soviet pieces. To most listeners, those who liked it and those who hated it, the 11th seemed the very embodiment of the doctrine of socialist realism. What made it such a perfect example of that state-sponsored aesthetic? Well, first, the fact that it was explicitly written for the 40th anniversary celebrations of the 1917 Bolshevik Revolution, and that it purported to memorialize another sacred date in Soviet history, the 1905 Revolution. Then, there was the all-too-neat way it fulfilled so many of the musical ideals of socialist realism. It was heavily pictorial and programmatic. It often sounded like film music, a very good thing for a socialist realist. Most of the thematic material was not the composer's own, but drawn from 19th-century revolutionary songs that most people in the audience would already know and love. This was another very important qualification for socialist realist music. And finally, its harmonic and orchestral language was deeply and obviously indebted to 19th-century Russian nationalist music, Mussorgsky, Tchaikovsky, Rimsky-Korsakov, and the rest. One particular listener at the time of the first performance understood all of this in a completely different way. She was no special friend of Shostakovich's and no musician, but she was one of Russia's greatest 20th-century poets, Anna Akhmatova, who lived from 1889 through 1966. Zoya Tomashevskaya, the daughter of a famous literary critic, remembered the occasion well. At the premiere of the 11th Symphony, there was a lot of discontented muttering. The music-loving connoisseurs alleged that the symphony was devoid of interest. All round, one heard such remarks as, "He has sold himself down the river, nothing but quotations and revolutionary songs." Anna Andreevna Akhmatova kept her silence. "For some reason, my father couldn't attend the concert. When we came home afterwards, he asked us, 'Well, how was it?' And Anna Andreevna answered, 'Those songs were like white birds flying against a terrible black sky.'" Akhmatova had evidently been deeply moved. To another friend, she commented, "His revolutionary songs sometimes spring up close by, sometimes float by far away in the sky. They flare up like lightning. That's the way it was in 1905, I remember." Akhmatova had put her finger on one of the three keys to this symphony, the extraordinary and vivid choice of 19th-century songs that provide most of the melodies. The other two keys are the way the symphony develops ideas from one of Shostakovich's own compositions, the sixth of his 10 poems on text by revolutionary poets, Opus 88, a work for unaccompanied chorus written in 1951. And finally, there is the way almost the entire symphony seems clearly modeled on a crucial work of music from Russia's past, one of Shostakovich's personal favorites, Mussorgsky's mighty historical opera about a revolution, Boris Godunov. Echoes of the crowd scenes from Boris, from coronation to revolution, abound in all four movements, and there are also specific references to details of Mussorgsky's piece, including the famous two chords of the coronation bells. All three of these keys to the mystery bring us to the intriguing realization that this is one of the most purely Russian of all Shostakovich symphonies. There is hardly a hint of Mahler, who was so important as a model from the first to the tenth. The 19th century revolutionary songs that so excited Akhmatova are little known to American listeners, but to Russians of the early 20th century, these lyrics and tunes were part of their cultural inheritance, rather like the battle hymn of the Republic in the United States. The first movement opens with Mussorgskyan scene-setting music establishing the place, Palace Square, in the middle of St. Petersburg, and the time, the hour before dawn on the fateful day of January 9th, 1905, at the moment when the Russian Revolution of that year began. We hear the frozen stillness of the river Neva in the darkness, the distant sounds of military bugles calling revelry in the barracks, and the equally distant chanting of the Russian Orthodox prayer for the dead, Kontakyan. Then, like an echo from one of the prison cells in the Peter Paul fortress immediately opposite the Winter Palace, we catch the first of those songs Akhmatova recognized, Listen. This was a popular ballad with 19th century political prisoners and often sung in Stalin's gulags, too. It tells a convict story of hearing a fellow prisoner being led out to early morning execution. Shostakovich introduces it on the gentle sound of two flutes like two trumpets playing in the distance just after an eerie passage of softly beating drums. Like the deed of a traitor, like the conscience of a tyrant, the autumn night is black, but blacker than night looms out of the mist, a gloomy vision of the prison, all round the lazy stepping of the guards in the quiet of the night. But there it is, like the tolling of a bell, lingeringly, longingly, the echoing call, Listen. A little further on in the movement, after a reprise of Listen in the bassoon, violins, and violas, Shostakovich introduces a second melody, gloomy and hymn-like, first in the cellos and basses, then in the flute and clarinet. This is The Arrested Man, a song from 1850. The night is dark, seize the moment, but the walls of the prison are strong, and the gates are locked with two iron padlocks. Along the corridor there faintly flickers the watchman's candle and the jingling of the spurs of the sentry who longs to live. There follows a brief-filled exchange of words between the two equally oppressed individuals, a despairing prisoner and the sentry who cannot help him. The second movement mostly plays not with tunes from early songs, but instead with melodies taken from the second key ingredient of the 11th Symphony, Shostakovich's own unaccompanied choral setting of Arkady Kotz's poem written in the aftermath of the catastrophe it describes, the bloody Sunday massacre that took place in front of the Winter Palace on January 9th, 1905. Bear your heads, bear your heads. On this bitter day, the shadow of a long night trembled over the earth. In musical language vividly reminiscent of the choral scenes from Mussorgsky's Boris Godunov, the unarmed protesters carrying portraits of Tsar Nicholas II process to his palace to ask for his help. Hey you, Father Tsar, look round you. We have nothing to live on. Your servants give us no help. After a climax in which the orchestra repeats over and over again the phrase, bear your heads, Shostakovich returns for a moment to the opening of the symphony, to the prayer for the dead, and again, the sound of the old song, Listen. The third movement, Eternal Memory, the Russian name for the ancient chant we call the Kontakyan, which we already heard at the beginning of the symphony, is a funeral march or processional. It starts with the revolutionary funeral song, You Fell as a Victim. You fell as a victim in the fateful struggle of selfless love for the people. You gave everything that you could for them, for their lives, their honor, and their freedom. Sometimes you were tormented in dank prisons. Your merciless sentence had already been decided for you by the executioner judges, and your chains rattled as you walked. This lovely old tune is soon answered by a stern revolutionary marching song. Here, Shostakovich combines several different sources into a single musical utterance. The most prominent melodies here come from two songs. The first begins, Bravely, comrades, step forward. Your spirit has been strengthened in the struggle. Let us lean our bodies forwards on the road to the kingdom of freedom. We all come from the people. We are the children of working families, brotherly union and freedom. This is the slogan that takes us into battle. The second song at this point is called Hail Free Word of Liberty. And the finale of the 11th begins with a fiery revolutionary march. Rage, you tyrants, and mock at us. Threaten us with prison and with chains. We are stronger than you in spirit, though you trampled on our bodies. Shame, shame, shame on you, you tyrants. This is followed in an extended marching sequence for the strings of the orchestra alone by one of the most famous and catchy of all revolutionary anthems, the so-called Warsaw Song. Malevolent whirlwinds blow around us, dark forces press down on us with hate. We have engaged in the fateful struggle with our enemies. The fate that awaits us is still unknown, but with pride and courage we will raise the battle standard of the workers' cause, the standard of the great struggle of all peoples, for a better world, for holy freedom. To the bloody battle, holy and true, march, march onwards, you working people. The violence unleashed in this final movement is astonishing, overpowering with its sense of uncontrollable rage. The symphony ends with a last return to Shostakovich's own 1951 chorus and its opening words, repeated over and over again and at deafening volume by the whole orchestra, "Bare your heads, bare your heads." And that brings us back to the meaning of this symphony and to Akhmatova's brilliant description of the songs in it as like white birds flying against a terrible black sky. This piece may indeed be about the 1905 revolution, that bloody upheaval whose eventual failure led directly to the 1917 revolution and the establishment of the Soviet Union. Then again, when Shostakovich wrote it, his country was only just emerging from the nightmare of the Stalinist terror and the mass executions and imprisonments by means of which the Bolsheviks continued the old tyranny of the Romanov emperors in new and vastly destructive forms. And in the year in which it was composed, the USSR invaded Hungary and bloodily repressed the uprising there, an event which caused many Western communists to tear up their party cards and made many more in the Soviet intelligentsia, to which Shostakovich belonged, despair at the workings of their own country. Shostakovich himself never explained this music beyond leaving its pictorial titles to tell a clear story of 1905, almost in the manner of a children's cartoon book. But when we hear and listen to its not-so-hidden words, and almost every bar suggests words, then we quickly see what the composer is talking about has many more layers of meaning than we first suspected. This is a symphony not about one event, but many events, and about how any one of us approaches those events in the darkness of our conscience. Notes by guest annotator Gerard McBurney on the Shostakovich Year 1905, Symphony No. 11. I'm Rich Caparella. Thanks for listening.